Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Eric Larson, whose latest book is The Devil in the White City, subtitled Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America. Eric Larson is the author of Isaac Storm and other works. When I first heard of Devil in the White City, I thought it was fiction, but it's not. It's two stories which converge. One is the story of America's first urban serial killer, as you call him, and the other is the in-depth story of the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago. Let me start by asking you, what put you on to this story? I know that you were doing research on Isaac Storm. What did you find out, and how did that stimulate this?
Well, really what happened, actually, is it goes back even before Isaac Storm, but in a very real sense, both books came from the same event, which was that back in 1994, I read a book called The Alienist by Caleb Carr, which is this great book about a fictional serial killer operating in old New York, 1890s New York. And the thing I really loved about that book was its evocation of that old lost time. I was in the market for a book idea, so I thought, why don't I think about doing a book about a nonfiction book about a historical murder, about a real murder, and see if I can sort of evoke some of the same sense of time and place. So I started looking into the history of murder and immediately came across the serial killer in my book, the devil, if you will, who was known most commonly as Dr. H.H. Holmes, although his real name was Mudgett. And to tell you the truth, initially I rejected him quickly as a subject for a book because his mode of killing, his murder hotel, everything was just so over the top, you know, outrageous that it was almost too lurid. I didn't want to do murder porn. You know, I wanted to do more a book about manners and time and so forth. So I started looking into other things, looked into another murder which led to Isaac Storm. There was a hurricane connection. But then after Isaac Storm was done, I was looking again for an idea, tried on, you know, a couple of dozen things, that none of them which seemed to work out. Remembered this guy Holmes, still didn't do a book about him, but there was always this tantalizing reference to the World's Fair of 1893. So one day, really kind of in desperation, I started reading about the World's Fair, and that's when I was instantly hooked because, I mean, it was just, I mean, magical is an overused word, but it really was a magical thing. And I realized, however, that I didn't want to do just a book about the fair. It didn't interest me. Didn't want to do a book just about Holmes, but there was something about the unity of these two characters. The fact that both these things happened in the same place, literally at the same time, was just too perfect.
It's kind of hard to bring them together. I mean, you sort of do in various places because Holmes took people to the fair, and his hotel was used for tourists at the fair. But the book itself focuses not merely on Holmes. He's actually a lesser character. The real protagonist of the book is a man named Daniel Burnham, who created the world's first skyscrapers.
Well, Daniel Burnham at the time of the fair in the 1890s was one of the most prominent architects in the country. And just prior to the fair, he and his partner, John Root, were indeed pioneers in the techniques of tall building construction. And, in fact, together built or did the architecture for the first building ever to formally be called a skyscraper. Now, there's this whole semantic war between Chicago and New York. I mean, Chicago thus claims to have hosted the first building that ever became called a skyscraper. New York claims to have the first skyscraper. It's just a question of timing and size and so forth. But Burnham and his partner, Root, were those who built the first thing that was ever called a skyscraper. And they pioneered various techniques for building tall. And thus were lead candidates for selection once Chicago received the right to do this World's Fair.
Now, the very, very first World's Fair was in Paris. Is that correct? Were there any before then?
Well, I don't think that was the very first World's Fair. But to tell you the truth, I'm not sure. But the Paris Fair, however, was a very, it was a spectacular World's Fair. And the reason that's significant in the context of my book is that at that World's Fair, the French completely overwhelmed every other exhibitor, every other exhibiting nation, including the U.S., and really sort of a humiliation for the U.S., especially the Eiffel Tower, which was built for the Paris Universal Exposition of 1888. And, you know, the Eiffel Tower in particular sort of claimed for France the honor of being the best nation at engineering and so forth. And, you know, this is hard for the U.S. to deal with. So when the idea came up that there should be a World's Fair to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the discovery of America, which is what this was, everybody sort of realized that this would be a great way to at last kind of shove it to the French. So you see that, you know, French-American relationships have always been, you know, somewhat tenuous. And that kind of led to, kind of intensified the interest in the fair. In building the World's Fair of 1893, Daniel Hudson Burnham did much more than simply build a fair. He built a dream city. Not just the structures, but how that city operated. Because one of the things that was very important was to lure as many visitors as possible. And to do that, he had to make sure that there would be no disease outbreaks, there would be no crime, and so forth. So, you know, here was this city that not only looked gorgeous, but also had a truly effective police force, which is something Chicago had not seen before. It had pure water. It had a sewage treatment plant, all of this stuff. And after the fair, I mean, this was not lost on anybody. Everybody realized what Daniel Burnham had done here was create the model city. People began to think, you know, civic authorities in various cities around the world began to think, you know, if this guy did this in Chicago, maybe he can help us, you know, figure out an orderly way of dealing with the growth of our cities. Cities like Cleveland, Buffalo, San Francisco was another city that came to Burnham for citywide plans, the first citywide plans. And Chicago, of course, ultimately came to Burnham also. And then that's, in fact, why Chicago's lakefront looks the way it does today.
Is because of Burnham.
Because of Burnham, because he was really the modern the pioneer of modern urban planning.
Let's go back and talk about what the era was like, because the era itself forms almost another character in your book, Eric Larson, Devil in the White City. It's called the Gilded Age. At the time of the fair, the economy was tanking very badly, and you had the robber barons, who may be equivalent to some of the corporate kleptomaniacs that we see today. In fact, the parallels between that era and today kept rising to the surface.
Well, you know, the robber barons were very much akin to the, you know, as you put it, the kleptomaniacs of today. Although I would say that there was a fundamental difference in the Gilded Age. Today's kleptomaniacs are purely kleptomaniacs. I mean, I don't see any redeeming benefit. But in Burnham's time, in the time of the fair, the robber barons, yes, they were just rapacious when it came to business. They also had a pretty profound sense of civic goodwill. And, you know, everybody pulled together, for example, for this World's Fair, and not entirely to earn a profit. I mean, this was Chicago's honor and also the nation's honor at stake, and that was a big driver. So while there are affinities, there was that very significant difference.
You go into some of the labor management issues here. Minimum wage came up at the
right
time. What was the politics like? There was the mayor was a populist, Harrison?
Oh, yeah. He was very clearly a populist. People adored Harrison. He was a kind of that terrific combination of somebody who could actually get things done, but also had a tolerance for the weaknesses of mankind, and a real tolerance for vice, and he was no Giuliani, you know. I mean, he was as effective as a Giuliani, but he also allowed people to be people, and the people, you know, the people of Chicago really appreciated it. They called him our Carter, you know, with the badges when they wore. But, you know, in terms of the labor situation, it's interesting that a lot of things were coming together at the time of this fair, one of which was the rise of organized labor. Organized labor, the leaders, recognized that here was this World's Fair. Everybody knew that there was very little time to build this World's Fair. Labor targeted the fair from the beginning as a terrific way to gain some leverage to win things that people wanted, that they wanted for their workers, the eight-hour day, minimum wage, and so forth. And actually wielded that lever very effectively in the case of the fair. To sort of combat that, if you will, Daniel Hudson Burnham created what was described as a workers' paradise at the fair grounds. He built workers' lodgings, boarding houses, complete with a refectory where the men got three really good filling meals a day, which is unheard of for an employer to provide meals and lodging of this caliber for his workers, free. And so on the one hand, it was this absolute paradise. It was also one of the more dangerous places to work because work was proceeding at an incredible pace and they were dealing with electricity and immense heights and so forth. But he was really doing all he could to sort of keep labor at bay.
Well, this was 1893. This was like 20 years after the fire. Had Chicago been completely rebuilt by that point?
Yeah, actually, Chicago, by the 1890s, Chicago was very urbanized. large buildings. Photographs of the city in the late 1880s, 1890s look very much like a big urban place one would expect it to look. The rush to build after the big fire had after the Great Fire had been incredibly intense, and yes, the city was pretty much was completely rebuilt by that point. And that's partly why Burnham and Root prospered, because there was so much need for construction.
At that particular time, there were things that were kind of in the transition between one age, the Dickensian age, and the modern age. Yeah. One thing that is more in keeping with that age was that nobody paid attention to who people were. They tended to believe them. So Holmes didn't need any proof of ID, and people right. who came to his hotel could disappear and no one would
Very
know.
Very much so. I mean, a lot of things were contributing to that. One was that there was this sort of almost charming naivete about the period. For example, credit for the purchase of consumer goods was really easily available for the first time. I mean, yes, credit had been available in rural areas for seed and so forth, but for furniture and bicycles and so forth, really for the first time. And the serial killer, Dr. Holmes, used that absolutely to his advantage, not just in covering up his killings, but for the many financial scams. Like, I mean, yes, he was a bicycle fanatic, and he was, as into the new bicycle craze with the new safety bicycles, that is, two wheels of the same size instead of the one giant wheel, He was as much into that as the next guy, but he also figured out a way how to fleece the bicycle companies by buying bikes on credit and then reselling them and never making good on the debt to the bike companies, that kind of thing. But they went with it because, it was such a naive time, and he was this pathological liar who could persuade them that, oh, there was a perfectly valid reason for this, they'd eventually get their money, and blah, 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 blah.
And no one ever talked to anybody else, so people were disappearing right and left from the hotel.
Right. Right. But there were other forces involved. Yes, there was the naivete, that's one thing. But the rise of the city was probably the most important force. This was the age of urbanization and industrialization, and Chicago was growing faster than almost any other city. Huge influx of immigrants, young women on their own for the first time really in American history, expecting to have careers and live on their own in Chicago. There's this huge cacophony in Chicago. I mean, an inept police force linked with all these other forces growing. It was a very easy place to disappear, and people did on a routine basis.
Chicago Fair itself, when I look at the images, are there any books of just photos from the fair that people can find?
Yeah,
what would people look at? I mean, I was fascinated. There's only like three or four photos in here.
Yeah, and if you want the long story of why I only have those few, I will gladly tell you. Well, philosophically, I am opposed to photographs in a book of this kind. It is not my intent, nor is it an area of my expertise, to provide an illustrated look at the World's Fair. What I bring to the party is writing about this, bringing it alive through text. If it were completely up to me, I wouldn't have had any photographs in the book. And the main reason is that, in a book like this, you end up with a signature, so-called signature of photographs at the center, on glossy white paper. Pictures that are way too tiny for really effective reproduction, because you can't, it's not a coffee table book. But the biggest danger is that when you've got that signature at the center of the book, as people start to read the book and as they go through the book, they start thumbing back to the signature at the heart of the book. First of all, it's easy to find because it's glossy white. But the problem is, in thumbing back and forth, you're disrupting the flow of the experience. I'm not a professional historian. I'm a writer who tries to bring alive these lost stories. The way I put it in the past is I'm an animator of history. I want you to begin this book with a glass of brandy, sitting by the fire on a cold night, and sink into the past and emerge ideally at the end of the book. Having a signature of photographs is one of the best ways I know of to interrupt that flow.
Now that I've read the book, where do I go?
I'll tell you where to go. One great source is to go to, check it out on Google. Go to the Chicago Historical Society. Go to their website. There's a gallery of photographs of the fair. Even better, if you want to be a little industrious, is to go to the Library of Congress online and go to the photographs and plates portion of the online database, and they've got some fabulous photographs. It's very easy to use. Just plug in World's Columbian Exposition, and boom, up come the photographs.
You're listening to an interview with Eric Larson, whose latest book is Devil in the White City. Before we move on to your own research, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the fair and some of the other elements here. The fair produced a fair number of items that became standard. shredded wheat, which was not popular but survived, Cracker Jacks.
Right.
You mentioned parenthetically zippers.
Yeah, the zipper was introduced to Americans at the World's Fair, as was the vertical file, if you can believe it. I mean, it was an invention of Melville Dewey, who gave us the Dewey Decimal System, who was also a notorious anti-Semite, I should point out.
Also the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance was written, see, the legislation for the World's Fair, those who crafted this, everybody recognized that the time to build the fair was quite short. If the fair was going to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of the Americas, or of America, depending on your view, it would have to have opened in October of 1892. And everybody recognized that was simply not enough time. Not even Burnham could pull that off. So what they resolved was that the fair would open May 1st, 1893, but would be dedicated in October 1892. And the one largest building at the fair would ideally be done by then. Of course, that ultimately turned out to be the most problematic building. But for Dedication Day, the Pledge of Allegiance was written as meant to be a recited all at once on that day, simultaneously by the school children of America, as a gift to the nation.
Even though it's not here, it seemed to have prompted one of the elements that prompted the naming of Star Spangled Banner as a national anthem, because at the time, My Country Tis of Thee substituted.
Yeah, My Country Tis of Thee was, there was no formal national anthem at this time, but My Country Tis of Thee was considered the de facto national anthem at this time, which I thought was very charming. I had never known that. You know, it's just one of those little details of the fair and the era that's kind of fun.
How did you find out that the song da 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 from Belly Dancing? How did you find out that that was written for the fair?
That is in a memoir by the guy who came up with the song, Saul Bloom, who at the time of the fair, just before the fair, was an empresario. Young empresario in San Francisco. In fact, he worked at the Alcazar Theater, where one of his jobs, by the way, was to raise what were called claques, that is, to recruit a group of people, pay them money in order to cheer for a particular performer. Every performer, even the top performers, when they came through town, they would hire somebody who would bring a claque to cheer for them, and thus, you know, improve their standing in the audience and in the eyes of the city. But Saul Bloom was the guy who was put in charge of the fun and games part of the World's Fair at such a young age. Burnham just trusted him at first meeting. And he was also one of the foremost promoters of the belly dance. And so one day he brought one of the lead belly dancers to a press conference where he expected to find an orchestra that would know something about this kind of music, but instead found a lone pianist and a piano. And the piano player had no sense of what kind of music would accompany a belly dance. And so on the spot, just kind of standing there, thinking about it for a bit, he started to hum this, wrote it out. Pianist worked it into a longer piece, and that forever after was the song. And Solomon regretted that he never copyrighted it because he would have made a fortune.
Also, even though they weren't invented for this, elevators played a role as well.
Yeah, elevators had been invented prior to this, and also the safety elevator, which was a very important advance because with a safety elevator, if you cut the cables, the elevator wouldn't fall all the way to the ground. But what the fair did was, bring the development of elevators another notch. Very fast, high-speed elevators, high-speed electric elevators, very important advance, and introduce these to Americans. Because prior to that, elevators had been hydraulic. Electric elevators had begun to emerge prior to the fair as well, but really it was at the fair that people experienced these things for the first time. And it was that experience of so many things for so many Americans that was so pivotal in this fair's influence.
Well, every fair, of course, has that one element that makes it itself.
The Ferris wheel, the very first, yes.
Now, the Ferris wheel itself, it sounds like in its construction, nobody knew what would happen, and they kept loading more and more people on it. That was a recipe for disaster, and they lucked out.
Well, whether they lucked out or whether they just had a superb engineering sense, you know, it's very hard to say. It's tempting to think that they just avoided disaster by a hair's breadth. One doesn't know. The bottom line was nobody had ever built anything like this on this scale ever before. It sprang from the imagination of George Washington Gale Ferris, a Pittsburgh steel engineer, the guy who invented this, in response to a challenge by Daniel Hudson Burnham. Burnham, while he was very pleased with the designs put forth by the architects of America, among them Charles McCam and Richard Hunt for the fair, he was very disappointed that no engineer had come up with anything to challenge the Eiffel Tower. I mean, people had come up with plans for taller towers. Even Eiffel himself had offered to build a tower for Chicago, which was turned down out of sheer, you know, hubris and sort of national pride. So Burnham issued this challenge at one memorable lunch to a so-called Saturday Afternoon Club group of engineers, where he really pretty much insulted them. And it was there that Ferris, who'd been thinking about this giant wheel thing for a while, said, okay. He said to himself, this is going to be my offer here. And what he created, and it worked on the first shot, as incredible as it may seem, was this monumental Ferris wheel that will challenge anyone's sense of what Ferris wheels are. I mean, this thing was, at its highest point, you were roughly equal to the crown of the Statue of Liberty. This thing carried 36 cars. Each car carried 60 people, 6-0, and had its own little lunch car. And, in fact, on Chicago Day, the day of the biggest day at the fair, John Philip Sousa packed himself and his band into one car, and they played their music as the Ferris wheel just went around and around and around. It was an amazing machine.
One of the great ironies is I was in Paris in 2000, and the centerpiece of the 2000 exhibition in Paris were Ferris wheels.
Ah, really? That's great. That's great.
The Midway. Was this the very first Midway?
Well, that's where the name comes from, is the World's Fair of 1893. Midway, the Carnival Midway. The term comes from this. Because, you know, the fair itself was in Jackson Park, and that was to be the sober, heroic monument to everything America did well and everything Chicago did well. But there was some concern that there needed to be some fun at the fair. This concern was expressed in particular by Frederick Law Olmsted, who did the landscape architecture for the fair. Another terrific character, has a big role in the book. So a decision was ultimately made that there should be these sort of concessions, the fun and games part, that would be constructed along a one-mile boulevard that stretched from Jackson Park to Washington Park. That boulevard, by the way, fronts what is now University of Chicago. The boulevard at the time before the fair was named Midway, and hence, ever since then, it's the Carnival Midway.
And where was that in relation to the park itself?
If you can picture a sort of a trapezoid on the lake and a one-mile extension striking due west of that trapezoid, that's where it was located, connected to the fair as a sort of a protrusion.
After the fair closed, there was a fire which destroyed the peristyle.
Right.
Then there were some arson fires set due to labor unrest shortly thereafter.
Right.
What happened to the rest of the buildings? You don't go into that.
First of all, the fair structures were built really to be temporary structures. They realized early on that if they're going to get these things done in under 2 years, they could not be built of permanent materials like sandstone and so forth. So the decision was made to make them, especially the largest structures, steel frames, wood cladding covered with this material called staff, kind of plaster of Paris with various fibers worked in.
Is that the same stuff that's used in San Francisco?
I believe so. At the Palace of Fine Arts,
yeah.
I believe it was the same thing. And this stuff mimicked really nicely. You could work with it in many, many different ways, and it mimicked the look of stone. The problem was that meant that all these buildings were essentially temporary. That, plus the fires that ultimately claimed some of the buildings, resulted in the fact that there are very few things left from the fair. I mean, if you go to the Jackson Park now, yes, there's still the Wooded Island, which was Olmsted's treasure. I mean, it's pretty wild now, kind of tangled like an unruly beard, you know. And there are some elements of the Japanese temple still on the island. But the main structure remaining, and really the only one of any significance, is the Palace of Fine Arts. Now, that takes some qualifying. What is there now, occupying the building that was the Palace of Fine Arts, is the Museum of Science and Industry, a terrific museum in Jackson Park. It is essentially a permanent, or as George Bush would say, permanentized structure, built out of permanent materials, brick, sandstone, and so forth. I'm not sure actually if it's sandstone, but it's stone and permanent materials, as a reproduction of the original Palace of Fine Arts, because, of course, that was built of temporary materials. So that's what's left. And there's really nothing much else. There is a replica, one-third scale, of the giant Statue of the Republic, which was this gilt female figure at the fair, but it's only one-third. It's big, but it's only one-third.
Eric Larson, in reading this book, I can see about two-thirds or more, three-quarters, is taken up with the fair story, which is why we focused on that. But the other part of it, the other third, taken up with two stories, mostly Holmes and a little bit about an assassin by the name of Prendergast.
Right.
Which it sounds like, you, as you stumbled in, you said, oh, I'm going to add that one, too?
No, you know where he came from was, I mean, so that's the beauty of real life. I mean, a lot of this stuff that's in this book, in this story of the fair and of the serial killer, frankly, if you were to write it as fiction, you know, here's the paradox. You know, nobody would buy it. Nobody would believe it. It's just too over the top. But because it all happened, you know, it's wonderful. The details are so rich. So here I am. I'm working on my narrative of Daniel Hudson Burnham. I'm doing the research on Dr. H.H. Holmes. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, comes this guy, Prendergast, who, and I don't really want to say what he does, because it's kind of a surprise. And in a way, this climactic thing that he ultimately achieves fuses, in my view, you know, sort of an odd way, fuses the two narratives, kind of brings everything together in a sort of a climax. But this guy was an assassin, an insane assassin, an insane, deeply troubled Irish immigrant who changes the denouement of the fair in a pretty remarkable way. And I just discovered him by accident. I didn't know this existed. And see, that's the beauty for me of doing this book, is that it's like every rock I turned over, there was some new surprise, something that just enthralled me.
The part of the book that focuses in on the fair is very, very heavily researched. I would guess that, you know, I couldn't find too many places where you conjectured it maybe a little bit in the opening and closing segment on the Olympic and the Titanic. However, there isn't that much about Holmes, and you get into people's heads. That fears awfully close to fiction.
Well, you know, I would quarrel with that designation. To me, the whole thing is nonfiction. And I'll tell you what was available about Holmes. A few really terrific documents. One was the detailed stenographic transcript of his trial published as a book, which I managed to find actually in my local law library in Seattle. And a second really terrific document was the account of the search for Holmes's last victims, the thing that really brought him ultimately to justice.
The children.
Yeah, the children. Terrific account by a staunch Philadelphia police detective that is absolutely accurate, very, very detailed, full of lots of primary documents, letters, interrogations, confession, and so forth. And then in addition to that, there were various things written by Holmes himself, which are problematic because, after all, the guy's a pathological liar. He had at least four confessions and one memoir from which one can find nuggets that check out with news reporting from the era, things that seem to be true. And then you also had fairly exhaustive reporting by the Chicago Tribune. And I have to say, I mean, even though you have to take sort of the yellow journalists of that period with a grain of salt, I have to say the Chicago Tribune did some very good work on this case, as did the Philadelphia Public Ledger, which was another newspaper that was very close to the case because, in the end, this guy Holmes was run to ground in Philadelphia. Even there, you know, obviously there are gaps in the Holmes story. What I did, here's how I approached that problem. In a couple of places in the book in particular, and these may be what you have particularly in mind.
The woman with the foot.
Impression,
yeah.
Well, the foot, now that's documented.
The foot is documented, yes. But her feelings at the time were not.
Right. But exactly. and what I argue, what I did in that case was, you know, here I'm progressing with the Holmes narrative, and a lot of these things, a lot of his murders are happening off camera because nobody really knows much about them. But it began to strike me that I really needed to somehow convey a sense of how bad this guy was and how he did the killings that he did. In the one case, a killing with chloroform, in the other case, a killing by locking a woman in this airtight vault. Now, there are certain details that are known about those killings, certain things before, certain things after, the likely weapon of choice, and also package that with what then one can learn reading the literature on psychopaths. See, I also had a forensic psychiatrist read the whole manuscript. He's the one who diagnosed this guy as a psychopath and also steered me to a lot of very good detailed stuff to kind of help fill some of the gaps. And I wrestled with this issue of how to deal with these murders, because I wanted to put us in the room with the victims. Obviously nobody was there, wiretapping what was happening. Nobody was telling us what was happening. So what I thought was, okay, well, first of all, I read In Cold Blood a couple of times, In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, to sort of try yet again to get a sense of how this guy did what he did, how the author did what he did. He doesn't leave footnotes, you know, which is, I think, a real shame, because I'd love to know. And then what I hit on was this strategy. And you can decide whether, you know, this is fiction or nonfiction. That's really up to you. But here's my strategy. If you ever cover a murder trial, if you've ever been to a murder trial, and if you were to miss the prosecutor's argument and the prosecutor's close, you'd see a bunch of disparate evidence brought forth. You wouldn't know what to make of it. It's totally far-flung. It's the prosecutor who creates a plausible theory for how that evidence fits together. That's my approach. What I do, I do Truman Capote one better. I have detailed footnotes. And in those places where I have, in that case, you know, tried to bring readers into the mind of Holmes and his victim in these two scenes, I detail in the notes what my reasoning was, what pieces of evidence I use, how I did it, and also then I list the concrete sources that buttress those scenes as a way of saying, you know, here's how I did it. You decide for yourself. And if you happen to be doing a thesis, God help you, a graduate thesis on serial murder, look up these newspaper accounts and you will find the actual sources. So you have to decide what that is.
After the book was finished, and when you'd handed it in, and between then and now, have we learned anything more about Holmes? Did people come to you out of the woodwork?
People have come to me out of the woodwork, and I'll tell you one of the most surprising things. I mean, I haven't learned more about Holmes. I haven't learned anything new. Nobody has any more facts that have come to light. But what was fascinating is that I gave a talk in New York at a bookstore on the Upper West Side. Two women were in the audience, and during the question-and-answer period of my talk, one of them raised her hand and announced that she and her cousin, I believe, or sister, I can't remember, were direct descendants of the serial killer.
Of Holmes.
Of Holmes, because he had
the first wife.
Well, he had two children from at least two of the three marriages, and he may have had more wives, no one knows. But anyway, so there they were. These descendants. And then since then, I have found Mudgetts, that's his real name, Mudgetts appearing from everywhere, you know, saying, oh, I'm related to him, you know, distantly, I'm this. It's fascinating, you know.
Among the people who pop up in your book, Helen Keller.
Yeah.
And you got that from her autobiography?
Mm-hmm. It's from a monograph about Frank Hall, the guy who created the Hall Braille writer. And he was displaying one of his inventions at the fair when Helen Keller and her escort came up, and she just gave him a big hug.
Buffalo Bill, who played a major role, in fact, in taking customers away from the fair.
Yeah, that was such a mistake on the part of the fair. They were so hung up on making the fair this sober, heroic thing that would blow out the French, you know, that when Buffalo Bill and his Wild West show, which is this tremendous thing, one of the hottest shows around, when Buffalo Bill came to the fair asking for a concession, they denied him the concession, calling his show an incongruity. So Buffalo Bill, not to be put off by this, immediately had his business manager lease land right adjacent to the World's Fair, where he set up his Wild West show. And really, at times, stole the thunder of the fair. And the irony is that his show was up and running, you know, well before other elements of the fair could possibly be brought up and running. And if his show had been in the fairground, they likely would have gotten a lot more attendance, even more than they actually got, which would have helped further sort of, you know, allow them to thump their chests against the French.
There's a sentence, and I just went past and I realized you never talked about it. Tesla was there as well.
Nikola Tesla, yeah, he was there as well. And you know, by that time, I have to say, I was on like World's Fair surprise burnout. And I thought, you know, there's all this great stuff, and Nikola Tesla was there, and, you know,
he was performing or something there.
He was displaying, you know, his coils and his ability to light a bulb through sort of essentially transmitted static electricity, you know. I just think that was great that, that he too was there, and more than simply being there was he was, you know, sort of the developer of alternating current, the guy who really kind of put it on the map. And it was the fair that presented to the world the very first large scale demonstration of the effectiveness of alternating current. So he was there not just in body but also in terms of sort of overall invention and spirit.
The fair ends. People are missing. Holmes continues, he leaves town, he goes off to different cities. Years pass, 2 years, until this detective, this dogged detective, discovers what happened. Now, speculation on your part, Eric Larson, what if the detective was not quite as dogged? We'd never know.
That's one of those interesting questions about history, you know, what if he hadn't been dogged, and if he hadn't lost his own, you know, daughter and wife in a fire, would he have been as dogged? That's another question to ask. Would these things have come to light? You know, you got to think. Here's how I look at that. Modern studies, you know, by the FBI behavior guys and so forth of serial killers shows that they can get on this accelerating, intensifying path that can ultimately lead to capture. It is clear in the case of Dr. Holmes, and without necessarily giving away too many details of this part also, it is clear that the serial killer, that Dr. Holmes, was flexing his muscles, if you will, that this was like the ultimate dark act, that he was in the midst of the ultimate dark act for him. And in fact got tripped up by accident because of something associated with it. I think if the detective had not been as dogged, if all these things hadn't come to, if he hadn't found the victims, I do think that Holmes eventually would have been discovered, because I think he would have tried something even bigger, even worse, and I think ultimately he would have been caught. Although it's tantalizing, one thing I will say is, if he had never been caught, but if the murders had been had sort of eventually come to light and he hadn't been caught, and there had been this lingering mystery, I think more people would know about him today, because there would always be that question mark. Jack the Ripper is still the world's icon of evil, and he killed, what, 5 people?
But nobody knew that these murders had even happened.
Well, I know. That's the other component. Yeah, that's the flaw in my argument, I guess. Yeah. it is tantalizing to think about, but suffice it to say that these were brought to light. You know, that this guy, in an amazing one-man search, well, one man with help periodically, covered by the nation's newspapers. I mean, it's like the classic sort of fugitive-like search, you know, brought this guy to justice. And it was a terrific story in itself.
The bookends of your book, Devil in the White City, the beginning and end, is about two ships that pass in the night, right. Literally the Olympic carrying Daniel Burnham, and the Titanic carrying one of the other major players in the fair, a man named Francis Millet.
Yeah.
Titanic went down and Millet was killed. How did you discover that that their paths had crossed?
This is one of the things that I was just so thrilled to find. First of all, Daniel Hudson Burnham left a diary, portions of which his self-appointed caretaker destroyed, but portions remain. And one long portion, deals with his sailing to Europe on the Olympic, which, of course, was the sister ship to the Titanic. And in that, he talks about the fact that his good friend Millet was on the Titanic sailing in the opposite direction. In it, he talks about suddenly having the desire to send a Marconi wireless, then brand new, from ship to ship. This was a novel thing. It was very cool. You know, he's going to send this to his friend Millet. And he gets this impulse really at about the time that the Titanic is sinking, which I just thought, my God, is this story ever going to stop getting good, you know? And it's interesting to construct those scenes, actually. I did a lot of research into the Olympic and, you know, found where the I knew, first of all, where Burnham's room was, his suite that he and his wife had reserved, because he mentions it in a telegram, and then there was this wonderful publication that details exactly where the rooms were. Whole schematic of the Olympic that was published at the time by a magazine that got into, you know, details of new ships. So you get a sense of where everything is, where the wireless was, where the Burnham's suite was, where the dining chambers are, and so forth. And you can bring all these details that you know were true details into that scene and sort of animate that scene. And so it just became this sort of marvelously evocative thing for me to see this happening. I mean, who could imagine that in addition to all this other stuff, one of the characters would die on the Titanic? I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
Eric Larson, no book is written without being informed in the time in which it is written. So when you are writing this in, say, 2000, 2001, 2002, and you're writing about a period a little over 100 years right. earlier, what do you see? Do you see connection? Do you divorce yourself from the modern time? What do you gain as the writer from doing that? And what can we gain from you as the author?
Well, I'll tell you, what I gain, I can talk about that specifically, because I think I, as author, I mean, I operate on the assumption that what I feel and think will in some way be transmitted to the reader and that he or she will think the same thing or feel the same thing. And what I get from this book, I get a powerful resonance, a way of looking at today through the lens of this book. Seeing what the similarities are, yes, and that's kind of charming. Like when I list the ailments that people suffered at the fair, I mean, I got a kick out of the fact that they counted these, let alone what they were. So these little connections to the past and knowing that the Pledge of Allegiance came from here sort of informs your time. And just kind of enriches your sense of where everything came from. The sources of things is always, I think, very interesting. But on a very different level, I think one of the most important messages that I got and that I hope the book will convey is the sense of what we have lost. And that is, overwhelmingly, this powerful sense of community acting and pulling together. It's the thing that you know, I can say without doubt, there will never be another World's Fair of this scale, of this success, of this glamour ever again, because you don't have that powerful sense of community, of people united in a sense of wonder and of belonging to a mass that has common interests. That's gone. And I think that, on the one hand, is very sad. I think it's also very important to remember that it once existed, and to always kind of keep that in mind when you go through your day.
Eric Larson, now this book is done. Are you working on another serial killer in another area?
No, I'm not. I may do another murder, but it's not a serial killer. But it would have another sort of a different connection. But you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And actually, if I did know, I wouldn't say, because, you know, it's never a good thing to spill the beans before you do it.
Do you see yourself writing fiction at some point?
Do you know what? When I was working in newspapers, every reporter has a novel in the drawer, you know, and I was the same way. And I've written, you know, at least 4 complete novels, you know, cover to cover that never got published, and always thought, you know, I wanted to be a novelist. But I got to tell you that writing what one might, I guess, I mean, I hate typecasting anything, but writing this sort of narrative nonfiction, you know, animating real life scenes, is immensely satisfying. And I feel no need to write a novel at this point. I may in the future, but no, I love this.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Larson, whose latest book is The Devil in the White City. I'm Richard Wolinski on Cover to Cover.